Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Jamie Ayton, the founder and coordinator of the Humanitarian Disaster Institute and the Arthur P. Reck and G. May Reck Associate Professor of Psychology at Wheaton College in sunny Illinois, where he specializes in the nexus between religion and disasters. Professor Ayton was formerly the assistant director of the Katrina Research Center and has been active in responses to a number of other disasters, including Hurricanes Rita and Gustav, the H1N1 pandemic, which actually caused me to panic, the 2010 Mississippi Delta and 2011 Alabama Tuscaloosa tornadoes, civil unrest in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami, as well as many other earthquakes around the globe. Sounds like a fun life. He is also a Cubs fan. I am not saying that all those disasters and the Cubs are related. Actually, I am. But I will let you draw your own conclusions there. Dr. Ayton is the co-author, along with his Wheaton colleague David Bone, of the new book, Disaster Ministry Handbook, that was just released from InterVarsity Press. If any of you listeners out there are pastors or members of a congregation, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy of this book, as it's filled with very practical advice and some worksheets to help you organize your fellow congregants in preparation for the unimaginable. We will link to it on our website and also on our Facebook and Twitter feeds, as well as a link to the Humanitarian Disaster Institute. So please visit us and check it out. Jamie, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, good morning, and thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, you were about to say something during the bio that about Hurricane Katrina or something, but I kept moving on. So what was that?
Well, when you were talking about it, it sounds like a fun life. You know, I have sometimes wondered if I chose wisely for a career path. A few years ago, I remember having just been to Haiti and also in Japan after the earthquake, and was talking to a colleague and asking how their summer was going, and they were talking about how they'd spent the summer in Italy at art institutes and museums, and then they asked me where I'd been traveling to, and I remember thinking, maybe I made the wrong choice somewhere along the road.
Well, yeah, it's when you became a Cubs fan.
Well, you know, I often do joke that my interest in disasters come by me honestly, that as a diehard Cubs fan for all my life, that I know something about tragedy and suffering.
Yeah, no, along with all of Chicago, but maybe someday. Someday they'll win. I have another question, too. The endowed chair that you have is called the Arthur P. Reck and Jean May Reck Associate Professor of Psychology. Why don't they just call it the Arthur P. and Jean May Reck Associate Professor? Because you're adding, like, one more word, and that business card has now got to be like a 3x5 card for you.
Well, you know, the nice thing is it does help my CV come across a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll take it.
All right. Are the two Recks related or something, or do you know any story about
them? Yeah, husband and wife, and they gave very generously to help endow this chair, probably, goodness, maybe 16, 17 years ago.
Mm. Well, that's very cool, and I'm glad that you're the recipient, because you're a very interesting guy, as I mentioned here before. One of the things that I omitted from your biography was that you actually moved to southern Mississippi just days, I mean literally days, before Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, which was when just about the time you were finishing up your graduate work. Now, were you intending to move there right before the hurricane? Are you one of those tornado chasers or hurricane hunters, or were you just lucky with everything?
I think lucky is probably the closest, but I'm not quite sure that's quite the word I would go for. But it definitely has kind of changed the entire kind of not only my career path, but even personal life in many ways. I had just finished up my doctorate in counseling psychology and really had no background in disaster work. You know, I think one time I had a professor who, in a class, we were talking about trauma, and he kind of coughed and under his breath, I think, said the word disasters, and that's pretty much all the equipping I had. And then we moved from the Chicago area down to South Mississippi, and then just 6 days later is when the storm hit. So my original goal for going down there was to study rural health disparities up in the Mississippi Delta.
Mm-hmm. And so was this your first hurricane that you've ever been? You're a Chicago guy by birth, I would assume. Is this your first major hurricane? You probably had tornadoes, but hurricanes?
Yeah, I grew up in southern Illinois and spent most of my life in the kind of Illinois, Indiana area. So I knew what to do with tornadoes, which was you go to the basement. But my wife and I, we didn't even know the storm was coming our way. That, as I mentioned, we just moved in and then we kind of lived out in the country, so we didn't have a telephone yet. And our cell phones didn't get a cell phone signal where we were living. And then the cable guy was supposed to be coming on Monday. So when I left work on that Friday, the last we knew, the storm was supposed to be hitting on the other side of Louisiana. And then over the course of the weekend, it shifted and was aiming right up for where we lived. And it wasn't until we went to this large church when the pastor got up and started sharing about the experience that we found out that Katrina was coming for us. And we really had no idea what to do because there the table, the water table is so much different that there's very few basements. So we weren't quite sure what to do or how to get ready. So it felt very helpless when that first happened.
Yeah, you start off your book with this great story of you in the church and finding out about this hurricane. You got to relay that story to us.
Yeah, so, you know, here we are. It's our first Sunday in the South. And I remember actually my family, we even went for a walk around our neighborhood. And I remember like the wispy clouds and just really feeling like, oh, we're finally settled after all these years of grad school. It's good to finally have a home and be settled in. And then this pastor gets up and in a slow southern drawl, gets up to the podium and says, if you remember Camille, you know what I'm about ready to say. And my wife leans over to me and she says, honey, who's Camille? And I jokingly said, well, she must be in the Old Testament. And then he goes on to talk about how Camille was actually one of the worst hurricanes to ever strike the U.S. about 30 years prior, and then goes on to start talking about this hurricane coming, this Katrina. And right after church was over, we were trying to decide, do we evacuate, do we stay, what do we do? And I remember asking one of the people in front of me, and their response was like, oh, don't worry about it. At worst, it's going to be like camping for a few days.
And
they were wrong, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what was it like? I mean, a lot of the news media was focused on New Orleans because big city there, and there was the flooding after the levees broke. But you're in Mississippi, and so you're down toward the coastal area. I've been through a lot of disasters. One thing I have not been through is a full-fledged hurricane. So what was it like during the hurricane and then in the aftermath? Did you evacuate? Did you stay there? What was going on?
Yeah, well, right after church, some of the people that we talked to in the pews really didn't seem all that concerned. That many of them kind of felt like, oh, there's all these warnings all the time about these hurricanes, but they're never as bad as they say they are. But at the time, my youngest daughter was probably just a little over a year and a half. And right before we moved from Chicago, there'd been a bad storm up here. And so she was a little nervous about storms. And we were kind of concerned about, well, even if this isn't as bad as they say it could be, you know, we don't want her first memory to be of this horrible storm in Mississippi. But we thought, well, let's go back to my office and check it out. So we go and we're sitting there in my office and I've got my youngest daughter on my lap and my wife sitting next to me. And we pull up on the weather service on my computer there. And that's when we kind of saw that famous NOAA image that everybody sees of Katrina, that's that satellite image, just this huge swirling disaster coming. And I'll never forget seeing that take up my whole screen. And so at that point, we're like, okay, if we're going to ride this out, we've got to get some supplies. So we went to a couple different stores, and almost all of the stores were completely bought out, you know, of anything that you might need to kind of make your way through. So then we went back to the house and decided, well, we think maybe we need to evacuate. And so before doing that, though, I remembered all these 9/11 commercials, those PSAs about this is what you need to do to get ready for a disaster. And so I'm like rummaging around through my house, trying to find stuff through boxes. And my wife's like, what are you doing? And I was like, hold on just a second. I remember these ads. I've got to get something to help us get prepared. And so finally, I remember going to the kitchen and in that junk drawer pulling out. And finally, I had what I needed according to all the PSAs to get ready. And it was duct tape. And so there I am, standing in the room with duct tape in my hand, knowing that's what I've been told I need to get ready for a disaster, and having no idea what to do with this duct tape, and just really felt helpless. And so at that point, we decided, okay, we need to get out of here. We need to evacuate. So we actually got out just in front of all those media images where you saw the cars just deadlocked for miles and miles. So we actually just got out right in front of that, and we started driving north, and I just started calling friends and family that we knew from the up north, and finally got a hold of a friend in grad school that lived in Nashville, and stayed with him for a while, and then eventually tried to get back in, couldn't because of all the problems that were happening, and got stuck over in Alabama with a friend that I went to school with, and finally my wife and daughter went back up to Indiana and stayed with our relatives, and I was able to finally get back into our home and back into the region.
And how did your home fare?
We were actually quite fortunate. We had roof damage and a lot of trees down, but just within our neighborhood, a lot of our neighbors had lost their homes where the trees had just like rocketed through their homes, and the tree damage and wind damage. So the things that, you know, you see a lot of the images on New Orleans where there's a lot of the flood damage, but in Mississippi, it was much more of the wind damage. So we got the brunt of the wind force. And so in a lot of places, it just looked like a giant bomb had gone off, and just everything was just scattered on all the trees.
Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of grace here because you just moved into your home, and so you're looking for disaster-related stuff, and you found a roll of duct tape in the kitchen drawer or something like that. But since that time, have you upped your preparedness? Have you become one of those prepper guys? Because I have to admit, I'm one of those prepper guys that has 3 months of food, a generator, additional gas, all that kind of stuff.
I would say that I don't know if I'd go as far as to say that I'm a prepper, but I do have enough supplies to get us through for a couple of weeks in our home. But one of the things that really stood out to me doing this work for the last little over a decade now is that oftentimes I think it's more important about the people that you have in place than just the possessions or the plan that's in place.
Well, that is good advice. And that's going to lead us into our discussion about how churches, how religious communities prepare for this kind of thing. And I have to ask you, as you mentioned in your graduate work, you weren't really studying disasters or disaster responses. You then experienced Katrina, and then now you're the co-director, founder of this Humanitarian Disaster Institute. How did you get from point A to point Z there?
Well, I think a lot of that has come through the research that I've been doing. That just the way that I'm wired, when there's something I don't understand, or if there's a problem that I'm not sure how to fix, research has always been kind of the avenue for me to be able to try to grapple with those types of struggles. And that was definitely the case after Katrina. So with just within weeks of the storm, my research team and I started studying the impact that faith played on helping to buffer against some of the negative psychological and physical health stressors that people were undergoing. And then I also started noticing real early on that local churches played an incredible role in responding, but very few were prepared. And there was a lot of reinventing the wheel. And then there was even some practices that seemed to be causing more harm than good. And so, again, just kind of dug right in with that research and started doing that work. And so the way I think I went from point A to point B has been through science, by trying to understand what are the best practices that are out there, and also by really learning from the people that I've been walking alongside during these tragedies.
You said that your team went into action and you started noticing churches being pretty involved down there in Mississippi and Louisiana. How did you get involved in the Katrina aftermath? What was the extent of your involvement? Were you just a researcher? Were you hanging out at your church saying, okay, we need to fill up some sandbags, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, one of the first experiences that happened was right after, so our university closed down for just about a month. And then I remember one of the first things our college president said after campus reopened was that the best thing you can do for the students is to try to get back to life as normal as possible. So whatever you were doing before the storm is what we ought to try to be doing now after the storm. So the friends who know me well weren't too surprised that within those first 6 days of me being in Mississippi, I already had a full research team up and running. And so one of the things that I did then afterwards was to pull my team back together
and said, all right, let's try to have some normalcy. Let's get back into doing research. And I started talking ideas for rural health disparities up in the Delta. And one of my students said, hey, why aren't we instead doing research here on the coast and right here in our backyard about Katrina? I was like, that's a great question. Why don't we do that? And so that's what we did. We, instead of doing this work up in the Delta, adapted some of the plans that we had and jumped right into doing work after Katrina. And as I started doing that work, a lot of the, with the churches, you know, a lot of them started saying, hey, we need training. We need resources. Or, you know, pastors were saying things like, we don't know what the problems and needs are in our communities. And so it started as research, but really grew into much more than that, where we were also doing research, training, consultation, was writing grants for faith-based groups down along the coast to help them through their work, and trying to provide support however I could.
That's a pretty cool story about how your own research becomes very useful to folks in a community. And then how did you pitch the Humanitarian Disaster Institute up at Wheaton? Was that a hard sell? Did people say, well, we don't need one of those, or did they just embrace that right away?
Well, Wheaton had actually, I had known a lot of folks in the Wheaton area for quite some time. I did my pre-doctoral internship up in the Chicago area and knew several folks from some different professional associations. So about 5 years in, or so, Wheaton was recruiting me to come up for the endowed chair. And one of the things that I shared with them was that if I was going to leave my community there in the Southeast, that I've seen a lot of researchers do disaster research poorly, where they kind of parachute in, get what they need, and then they leave the community without actually helping the community. And for me, philosophically, my research isn't just research for research's sake, but doing research to help those in need. So I had seen, though, some really good examples of groups like that, the RAND Corporation, Tulane, UCLA that I worked with, and saw how they did this work well, but they had an infrastructure in place that allowed them to do it from a distance. And so for me, that was one of the things that when I talked to Wheaton that really felt needed to be in place, and they were very supportive of that, especially with the graduate school, that it felt very congruent with the mission.
So That's really interesting. You have this Humanitarian Disaster Institute that is researching this stuff and then also providing help for folks. And then you wrote this new book, The Disaster Ministry Handbook. So let's get into that. You wrote that with your colleague David Bone, just published with InterVarsity Press. And again, we'll link to it. Here's the first question for you. Why should churches even care about this topic? I mean, don't we have local, state, and federal governments to help out during disasters? Because, you know, FEMA is always right there around the corner. So why not just let the disaster experts handle disasters and churches can handle bringing people to Jesus?
Well, you know, I think what you just described is exactly what I thought before going through Hurricane Katrina myself. And I think that's what most of the churches in that region thought as well. You know, there were even a lot of churches that have very well-established and very well-oiled leaf arms within their denominations. But one of the things that we found is sometimes disasters hit so hard that it overwhelms the larger system. You know, FEMA, it took a lot of time before they actually got on the ground to help. And even now, if you look at FEMA's materials they send out, they tell communities, you need to be ready to be on your own for at least about 2 to 3 days, sometimes longer than that, before we can even guarantee that we'll get in there. And even when they do get in, that oftentimes that they're promoting more this whole community approach, where they realize they need to be able to work with local communities to have a more effective response. And so I think for churches, they need to be aware that if their doors are open after a disaster, people from the community are going to come to them for help. And in fact, I would even say that even if their doors have been knocked down because of the disaster, people are still going to come to them for help. So it's there to be prepared and be ready.
Yeah, I hear what you are talking about when, you know, folks tell you to be prepared for 2 or 3 days, because I had my own experience with FEMA in the 1994 Northridge earthquake. And I wasn't directly affected by it. I was down the coast a little bit further, but I knew a lot of people and friends that, you know, were told, you know, don't worry about earthquake preparation. We're here to help you in just a day or two. But it took several weeks to get off the ground. So I wasn't at all surprised by the responses of FEMA in the Katrina situation, which brings up the issue of local communities, right? That people need to be prepared themselves. But as you mentioned earlier in the podcast here, it's about people, having people in place and churches. So that's the thing that you are really bringing to the table here, that it's a resource management with personnel, with human beings, that really matters the most. Now, in terms of your book, you have the disaster ministry handbook. What kind of disasters are we talking about here? Is this just a hurricane thing? Is it just natural disasters, man-made disasters? And are there any different responses based upon the type of disaster that we're talking about?
We've really tried to write the book to cut across a full wide spectrum of disasters. That kind of the working definition that we had in mind was anything that disrupts civil society. So that could be anything from a small scale, maybe an apartment fire, or maybe a bad auto accident that happens in a community that really impacts people, to full blown large scale hurricanes, tornadoes, these sorts of issues. Terrorism, for example.
Mm-hmm. And those are kind of interesting, and I found that quite interesting. You were involved in some civil unrest in the Congo, too, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I think the typical thing most people focus on are the natural disasters, your hurricanes, tornadoes, mm-hmm. earthquakes, forest fires, etc. So we'll kind of keep our attention there. And in terms of this book itself, of being prepared and having a disaster ministry in the can, so to speak, in case something does happen, who are you gearing this book to? Is it geared toward pastors? Are there certain types of congregations, mega churches, which might have a lot of storage space, or your small congregations? Who is this book for?
Again, we're really trying to speak to people wherever they're kind of at in their home congregations or churches, no matter what the size or resources they have. That overall, I really believe that preparedness and response is going to vary a lot based on each individual church. So there's not a one-size-fits-all or a cookie-cutter approach that's going to work best across congregations. But instead, what I'd really encourage churches to think about is, what is the unique calling of their church? What are the resources they have? And what is it they already do well? And to respond in a way that's theologically aligned with the beliefs of their congregation.
What does that mean, theologically aligned with the beliefs of their congregation and setting up your ministry there? Because it just seems like, well, you want to bring people to Jesus and you want to be kind of concerned with others around you. That seems to be pretty constant if it's United Methodist or Pentecostal. So what do you mean by theologically aligned with your mission?
Well, one of the things that I've seen is sometimes churches or the leadership within a congregation will try to start a disaster ministry, but they'll try to start in a place that's too far afoot from kind of the core ministries of their congregation. And that's where I start to see them struggle. Whereas congregations that try to really make sure that their help is coming out of their theology tend to be the strongest. So let me give you an example. There was a denomination that had a number of churches in the Southeast after Katrina that had a very kind of strong biblical justice perspective. And so instead of the denomination spending money on just rebuilding buildings, they looked for who were the most vulnerable and the most in need, and that was specifically where they targeted their help. So almost all of their funds went to social outreach programming to help the underserved. So I think the more that we can align with the unique perspective and calling of our churches or denominations, the more effective we're going to be.
And that's a really interesting point that you bring up here, that you figure out what your mission is, and normally we think about disaster relief as passing out water bottles and maybe a few go bags or something like that. But chapter 2 of your book really expands this, and you talk about justice, and justice and vulnerability become a big aspect there. What does that mean, and why is that included in the book?
Well, I think there's, you know, that common phrase that disasters impact all people, that it doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor, that you're still at risk for disasters. And that's very true, but I think that phrase has blinded us from the fact that even though we may all be susceptible to going through a disaster in our lifetime, disasters impact people differently based on their vulnerability. So, for instance, a person like myself, that when Katrina struck, my employment, the university, shut down for an entire month, but I still got a paycheck, and I was able to, even while evacuating, I was still working, and was able to even evacuate. I had a car, I had gasoline, I had cash that allowed us to be able to leave. But for those that have fewer resources, that when maybe the fast food restaurant that they worked at was destroyed, they no longer have a paycheck. And because they don't have a paycheck, they can't go out and buy gas to evacuate. And because they can't buy gas to evacuate, and so you start to see the spiral. And so in the disaster research, there's a theory called theory of conservation of resource loss. And the idea is that the more that you lose, it actually takes even more energy to regain a normal sense of operating or normal sense of life again. So those people that have fewer resources, they have a much higher ladder to have to crawl back up just to get back to a sense of normality.
Mm-hmm. And that's important too, because churches, they're uniquely positioned to offer support, not just financial support, the water bottles, the blankets, et cetera, and things like that, and shelter, but they can offer a lot of emotional, psychological, and spiritual comfort. And so where does that all work into the mission that churches in general play?
I think it really comes meeting people where they're at. So again, I think this is why I stress starting with what your congregation does well. So if your congregation really has a strong children's ministry, or maybe it's working at the elderly, or maybe they have Meals on Wheels, whatever that is, I think that's the best path to start with the disaster work. And the reason for that is that that means you're going to have contact with people not only in your congregation, but in your community. And that provides a unique venue for you to be able to reach out and provide that support and care. So just as an example, I took a team of my students. So I teach in the doctoral program at Wheaton. And I took a group of clinical psychology students to go help at a Red Cross shelter after some pretty bad flooding that happened up here in northern Illinois a few years ago. And we were at the center for a good couple of hours. And my students got to reach out and provide some basic psychological and spiritual care to a few people that came in. But then I was like, okay, team, what we're going to do now is we're going to work with one of the faith groups here, and we're going to spend the rest of the day muck out a house and help get rid of all the mud and everything. And as we went into this neighborhood to start doing that work, the students all shared about how they had way more opportunities to provide psychological support by helping mucking out those homes than they did sitting at the shelter. That it helped them to meet people where they were at and just think about, you know, what those moments are like where you're actually helping taking out possessions that somebody had that were maybe precious to them, and they're standing there watching that happen. But that's going to pull out these types of emotions in ways that you may not see in the other formal ways. And so it was right in those moments of being there, sitting with and walking with people, literally in the midst of crisis, is where we can be most effective.
That's fascinating that you're meeting people where they're at. And one of the big criticisms of religious aid during disasters is that it tends to be rice bowl Christianity, that it's just seen as another chance to proselytize, and people come in and say, we'll feed you so long as you listen to our message on Jesus. Actually, how does this stuff play out at the grassroots? I mean, you can use the example of students helping out mucking a house after a flood. Do they come in saying, hey, your life is destroyed, let me bring you to Jesus now? Or how does that play out?
I think that perspective that you're sharing, I think is somewhat, I think sometimes that's a bit of a caricature of what happens that may not be fully accurate. But at the same time, I do think there's that caricature there, because there are some groups that I do think sometimes unfortunately operate like that. I won't name this one particular group, but there's one that comes to mind where I was talking to one of the directors, and he was talking about the relief work as though like putting a notch on a belt. We saved this amount of people. And that was really concerning. But I think overall though, those sorts of groups, that's actually the minority. That the majority of the Christian groups going in, I think, are really trying to meet people where they're at in need and attending to the wholeness of their need, about the physical needs, the emotional needs, and also their spiritual needs, which do tend to come up in times of disasters. So I think most of the groups that are doing it are not doing it out of poor motivation. They're not trying to just convert everyone, but that they are actually trying to meet people where they're at. And when people are asking, why are you here? That they are sharing their faith, but not in a way that's coercive or trying to take advantage of people in times of great need.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the examples that you have experienced throughout the time in your research to give us an idea of what to do and what not to do. Let's go ahead and you talk about a number of case studies in the book. Let's start with the one that you first experienced firsthand was Katrina. What did you see on the ground with your research team? What worked and what didn't work?
I think one of the areas that I saw that did not work was when churches tried to do and go about the response solely on their own, when they tried to kind of be like a lone wolf, so to speak, that those were the churches that seemed to struggle the most. That for me, the most effective response was when the churches would all come together and meet together and figure out how to utilize each other's strengths and to leverage those strengths in unison as the full body of Christ. That to me, that was the most powerful response that I saw. Because you would have, instead of one church trying to be all things to all people, you might have a church that says, we're going to really focus on the elderly. Another church says, we're going to focus on trying to help people with insurance issues. Another church, we're going to go out and we've got all these water bottles stored. It was really a beautiful response when people worked together.
Is it working together just with other churches, or was there some degree of coordination too with local government officials, either local, municipal, or all the way up the chain to FEMA?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you see a continuum of that there are some churches that I think may at times have some distrust of working with government or other agencies, sometimes even churches not belonging to their own denomination. But there was a group after the Hurricane Katrina where there was a disaster task force that formed, and you had churches from all different denominations, so it was very ecumenical, that came together on a weekly basis. And then they also had people from, like, the public health department, departments of mental health, local emergency management, school teachers, this just a really diverse group. And this task force would meet weekly and did everything from planning to held conferences, raised funds. It was really quite remarkable.
Are you seeing a little bit better coordination over time since Katrina? Because I know one of the jibes at the response on Katrina was, well, the government was really slow in getting there. They basically taped off the whole area so that churches that did want to come in from other places around the United States were kept out, and it just really wasn't coordinated. Have you seen better coordination between government officials and civil society, and more specifically churches?
Oh, most definitely. I've really been quite pleased with the progress there. And if I can just give a couple of quick examples here, one being, again, in the Southeast, where, so not too long after Katrina, then there was the threat of Hurricane Gustav, which had some impact there on Texas and a few other places. But after Katrina, I helped a faith-based group write a grant where we developed a disaster clergy network. And one of the clergy members actually had a seat at the Emergency Operations Center in, I think it was Biloxi, if I'm recalling now, but it's like this big underground bunker. And so he was under in this bunker with the emergency management and all local officials. And then my job was to be on the ground to help take orders from emergency management that he'd pass along to the clergy so that they could actually network and work in unison with local municipal agencies. And I remember as that threat was coming that I started driving my family up north a little ways, and I dropped them off and met relatives. And then I was driving back to Mississippi so that way I could be ready on the ground. And as I was coming back, I saw all these cars evacuating, and then I was one of the few cars going in. But everything else that was coming in were emergency management and law and fire and all these other groups. And I was really impressed that they had learned not to wait till the event happened to get people in place, but that they were actually sending people ahead of time on the perimeter to get ready. But then I also thought I may have made a really bad choice by volunteering to be the guy on the ground. But that's just one example of how they're getting people into place quicker but they're also providing a seat at many tables in communities around the U.S. for faith communities. Another example of that would have been a couple of years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was invited to go to the FEMA headquarters. And while I was there, there was a large hurricane that was threatening to hit Hawaii. And so the Emergency Operations Center was in full task. And so I remember being in this large room with people from military, emergency management, FEMA, Homeland Security, all the major branches of the government. And then at the same time, though, they had a table and computer and a place for someone from the National VOAD, which is the Voluntary Organizations Active in Disasters, which is a large national group that also has state groups that organize and mobilize, many of them actually are faith-based, nonprofit groups. And so they're right there in the mix of all of these government groups. So they've really taken great efforts to try to help get the faith community and community organizations at the table.
Yeah, that's one of the things that has been very heartening to see since Katrina. There's a lot more interaction between civil society and government in trying to respond to this because, as you mentioned, you know, churches know the ground that they're walking on. They have specific resources designed to specific needs and communities, oftentimes better prepared than somebody out in D.C. Might be because they don't know the local area.
Yeah, and actually, you know, just another example, too, has been that within FEMA and Homeland Security now, there's a National Center on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships that's within the Department of Homeland Security, where they have a team that works to try to help encourage faith-based groups' connections to local emergency management and federal emergency management. And they've been very effective in that work.
Very, very good. That's kind of cool. One of the things that I know in your book, too, is that you're not only focusing here on the United States, but there's other places around the world that you've been to, and you're learning things by comparison. One of the places that you talk about is Japan. You were there after the earthquake, I think it was in 2011 or so, and then the tsunami that happened. And out here in the West Coast, we get some of the blowback on that kind of thing. Japan is not known as a place that has, I would say, a lot of spiritual energy, right? They don't have a lot of churches. It's not a very Christianized place. And even in terms of indigenous religion, Shintoism, it's a secular place. How was the response there with respect to ministries?
Yeah, it was very interesting that, you know, just like what you're talking about, that it is a very secular society. And if you look at the Christian faith in particular, that's a very, very small percentage of the overall population. And then also culturally, it's Christianity in Japan, from my perspective, has been fairly unique in that oftentimes when a member or a family converts to Christianity, especially evangelical Christianity, they tend to somewhat be ostracized from the overall culture at times, that, you know, they're giving up some of like the Shinto cultural beliefs and practices that might be very important to a community. And as a result of that, they might become slightly isolated from those communities. So here you have a small group that's been fairly isolated from larger parts of interacting with the culture. And then when this earthquake hits and the tsunami, the church was actually very active and responded to that in very unique ways. And one of the things that happened with that is that it actually opened up a lot of doors for them to be able to gain recognition in their communities and expand their ministries and really provide help and hope that you might not find from the culture in general.
Yeah. What about the Philippines? You were down in the Philippines too. Now, Japan is a pretty modernized society, very industrial, a lot of resources to respond to disasters. The United States, the same thing. Philippines, we get more into the developing world here. Are there specific challenges that churches face in those kind of areas?
Yeah, you know, earlier when you were asking me about, you know, so am I a prepper? Do I have like 3 months of food, that sort of thing? And I think one of the reasons why I respond to me that, you know, it's the people that are so important actually comes out of our work in the Philippines as an institute, that if you look at the Philippines as a whole, especially the places where we have been working the last several years, many of the people there can't store more than, you know, well, actually some may even struggle to have the food that they need just to get through the day, let alone trying to prepare for months in advance. And what we really saw there was the power of networking, congregations and communities and organizations together, that we held a large conference there in collaboration with the MICA Global Network. It was just 6 weeks before Typhoon Haiyan hit, and it was the first time that these church groups and local churches, but we also then brought in a number of Christian NGOs like Cheer Fund and those sorts of groups together to get them networking so that they would know one another. And then they formed an informal network that included churches, church organizations, and nonprofit like disaster relief and aid groups. And then when this disaster hit, they already knew each other. So they knew who to contact. They had a relationship, you know, they had a face to put with the organization, and worked together very effectively as a result of those relationships. And so it really made me a believer in the power of people over just possessions.
Yeah, that was a very poignant part in your book, because, you know, I come from a prepper mentality to some extent. And, you know, you want to go and tell people you need to have 3 days of food, 3 weeks of food, 3 months of food. But then you go down to the Philippines and you're going to some of these very poor communities and say, you need to have 3 weeks of food. And they go, hey, we're worried about the next 3 days. We're going to start, you know, cutting into those supplies right away. And you're like, oh, yeah. Right. And so the communities that you talk about, it's very important, because the people who cannot store all that stuff are going to need help. And it's that those networks of people who know where things are become very important. And I think that is a really cool aspect of your book, emphasizing the community relationships that matter the most.
Yeah. And, you know, just to kind of follow up on that, that oftentimes I kind of think of resilience as a muscle. That if we're not exercising, that we're not building up our capacity. And so communities like that in the Philippines that don't have the resources, then we have to start thinking about, well, where are the muscles? How do we strengthen them if we can't just make sure that everybody has enough supplies? And oftentimes that is by building those relationships, building social ties, helping the vulnerable to be identified, getting them connected to resources that maybe are available to them through their church or community. So there are things that we can do to continually to exercise our resilience muscles.
I want to talk about one last disaster that you have been involved in. This gets us a little bit away from the natural disasters of typhoons, hurricanes, earthquakes, and that's in the Congo. You were involved in civil unrest. Now, this is a man-made disaster, so There's more pieces moving than just the weather clouds or the tectonic plates. How does a response in a man-made disaster, such as civil unrest or a civil war, differ than one, say, natural disaster?
You know, I think for when we look at the civil conflicts versus, say, a natural disaster, I think it's important to realize that our focus on helping shifts probably more from just resources to really helping the heart, that much of the response that needs to happen there is happening at a very deep emotional and spiritual level for a lot of the survivors. So we've done some research there in the Congo, and then we've also worked with refugees, survivors of some pretty horrific violent acts who had been in the Congo and now have sought refugee status in the U.S., and then also have done some research just recently in Liberia around the civil conflict that happened there. And one of the things that we found through some of those different studies was that faith, virtues, and forgiveness all played major roles in predicting resilience among the survivors that we got to research.
Yeah. I can imagine that's just particularly challenging, and it really takes a different type of mentality or different type of spiritual congregation that to really make that effective response.
Yeah, they're really trying to help people make meaning and make sense of the atrocities that have happened to them. That I think there are some unique differences that happen between, say, a natural disaster versus terrorism or civil conflict, that through some of our research it would seem to suggest that a natural disaster we're more likely to attribute that experience to God in some way. You know, we even call those acts of God, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas like a terrorism event, you can actually sometimes point that here's the people that attacked us and actually point to them. Same thing in those civil conflicts, except with the civil conflicts, you tend to be more likely to have some sort of personal connection to those people.
Yeah.
So maybe it was your neighbor or maybe even someone within your own family. So there's this kind of extra layer of distrust and personal harm that are experienced by people.
And I think religious institutions are uniquely positioned to help out in those situations more so than, say, a government bureaucracy.
Oh, most definitely. And,
yeah.
You know, kind of circling back to just our conversation even about FEMA, that's been one of the things I've been encouraged about, that they recognize that faith communities are in a unique role and position to help communities really make meaning of this. And in fact, we just had an article accepted for publication that's led by my colleague, Dr. Daryl Van Togeren out of Hope College, where we found people who were able to make meaning after Katrina, that you saw the PTSD symptoms just drop significantly, where those people that really struggled to make meaning had much higher levels of PTSD. And in some recent studies, for instance, another colleague of mine that we're collaborating with, Dr. Joshua Hook out of University of North Texas, is doing some data analysis for us from the mass shooting that happened in Roseburg about a year, not quite a year ago now, at the college campus there. And he found that religious support helped to buffer against the negative psychological and spiritual consequences that a lot of people went through.
Mm. Incorporating those into the response is very, very critical. I want to spend the last 15 minutes or so here talking about things on a more practical level, because you wrote a book called The Disaster Ministry Handbook, which is it has worksheets in it. So you can use this to help prepare if you have a congregation. And again, it's one of these books that's filled with research, but also filled with practical advice and little boxes you can check off too to make it easy. So it's great for congregations, great for pastors, great for church elders. You should pick this up. Let's just kind of walk through what it means to make a plan for your congregation. Let's just take a typical 200-member congregation here in the United States, which I think is pretty much the average church. What do we do?
Well, one of the first things I would do is to make sure that I had the right people in the room, that some people who have picked up our book and have put it to use. Some have been pastors, but the majority of emails or phone calls that I've gotten from people that have used the book have actually been lay leaders within their congregation. That oftentimes the senior pastor may have way too much on their plate already. Now asking them to think about adding a whole nother ministry can be really challenging. So typically for these sorts of ministries to take off, there really needs to be kind of a local champion in the church who's saying, hey, I'm going to take responsibility for this. But then once that person's been identified, it's important to get the right people around the table, that you want people that are going to be well-respected in the church, that can motivate others into action, but also think about the unique talents and gifts and resources that you have in your congregation. You know, do you have somebody from emergency management or maybe a police officer or maybe there's a physician or a nurse? You know, look for people that have the unique skill sets that are going to be really able to help you carry out whatever your main mission goal is. So that would be the first starting point.
One of the other things you mentioned is that you need to build on prayer right there in the initial planning phases. What does build on prayer mean?
Well, one of the things that I have found is that oftentimes people who are attracted to doing this work, like myself, tend to be very, you know, here's the idea and we're going to push forward with it. You know, my wife sometimes jokingly, and maybe not so jokingly actually, refers to me at times as a runaway train. And what I've noticed is that people that are sometimes attracted to doing an emergency management type of work, that we can be pretty strong personalities and this is how we think it ought to be. But instead, I would encourage us to pause and to really reflect through prayer and seek God's guidance for what is it our congregation ought to do. You know, who are those really in need, and to really kind of slow down our response so that we're being more thoughtful and not just jumping into doing this work.
Yeah, I hear that, because I'm kind of one of those people who's like a prepper and just wants to get moving. But yeah, you need to slow down and reflect upon who is, you know, important, who's important to be in charge. And as you mentioned earlier, what is really the unique mission of the church, because what one person might think it is might not actually be what it really is. So you need to kind of do an assessment of what your congregation is doing, and talk about the importance of assessing your church's mission relative to the preparation you're doing.
Well, I think if you try to do something that's too far afoot from whatever your church's main mission is, that it's really going to challenge, it's going to be a challenge to get other people excited and on board with carrying out this new ministry. And one of the things that I have seen, but like I used to be, the way I used to think about this emergency management work within churches was that we take the model that's being used by like FEMA or relief groups, and we try to turn our churches into like mini relief organizations. There can be a time and place for that, but the ones that I've seen that are most effective at kind of like this grassroots organic level are the ones that kind of bake in disaster ministry into what they're already doing. So rather than it just being a whole separate entity, that it's actually integrated across ministries or a ministry within the congregation. So, for example, after Katrina, there was a congregation that had a lot of folks. So there's a large timber industry there. And there was this one church that had a lot of people involved in the timber industry. And so as a result of that, they often would go around and help people in their community and the church with things like taking care of the grounds, taking care of anytime there was like a storm, removing trees and things. But then during the Katrina, they formed a chainsaw ministry. So right here, they had people with talents and resources, and you normally wouldn't think of chainsaws as being a ministry tool, but I tell you, that was an incredible gift that they gave to the people in Mississippi by using those skills that they already had and had been using in other ways. So I would often encourage congregations to think about, again, you know, what is it you do well? And then in the event of a disaster, David Myers often uses this term that he encourages churches to pivot in the event. So taking what you do well and then pivoting to respond to the unique disaster needs ahead.
I love that term, chainsaw ministry, and that's going to get a tag here on the podcast, because I think people who are looking for chainsaw ministries on the internet should stop here to hear what you're saying.
you know, I once jokingly referred to that as chainsaw evangelism, and I was told not to do that again.
Yeah, man, that sounds a little bit too creepy, but chainsaw ministry sounds actually kind of neat. And a lot of churches often, you know, have those kind of odd base ministries. We have a lot of horse ministries or horsemanship ministries out here. In the area that I live, because it's what your talents are, right? And that's
exactly.
And that's really a kind of a cool lesson here. And I love the term that you used. You have to think about what's baked into your ministry, because that leads me to my next question, which is practicing, having practice drills, right? If you start we're going to have a disaster prep ministry, and you start that from scratch, you know, you can have it on paper, but it's something different to actually implement it, and you need to practice and drill. I have a lot of wilderness first aid training, and I realize that every 2 years or so I need to re-up that, because it becomes rusty over time. And if you do something completely new, you're going to have to practice a lot. But if you do something that is, as you say, baked into the ministry, you practice it on a weekly, monthly, or annual basis.
Oh, yeah. And it's so important that, you know, just think about any skill that we have, that over time, if we don't use it, that skill level or that competency tends to start to reduce, if not even maybe go away. Just as an example, I actually started off college as a music major. No, did not go that route for very long. And just about a year ago, I was like, you know, I'm going to pick up my saxophone and start, you know, see if I can play again. And just realized I didn't have the chops anymore, that, you know, my fingers weren't working with the notes the way that they should have been, that I'd gotten really rusty. And the same thing can happen with our disaster work, that so maybe you've gotten training, maybe you even have a plan in place, but if you've not practiced it, you're not really building and keeping up that capacity to respond.
Yeah. Incredibly important. And so, again, doing something, chainsaw ministries, if you're doing timber work, well, that just makes sense. You can now go clear roads because you know how to do that. Yeah.
Right. And really, it's wherever that gifting is, everyone in the church has a role to play. Just as an example, after the storm with Katrina, there was a group of elderly women at some churches that were trying to figure out, well, how can we respond? What can we do? You know, we obviously can't do this chainsaw ministry or, you know, some of these other ways of going out and working all day in the heat. But there was this group of elderly women that actually had a like a sewing circle, and they would get together and make quilts for families and churches. And what they ended up doing was asking people who maybe were able to salvage some of the maybe T-shirts or something from their homes, like out of material, they would take that and they created Katrina quilts for people in their community. And actually, I've got a friend to this day who had a Katrina quilt given to her from the after Katrina, and that's one of her most prized possessions because many people lost everything. But here's these women coming together and making this beautiful, you know, handmade crafted quilt that they're giving to someone that took hours and hours and hours, you know, of time and experience to be able to do that. And so they were able to help people even out of a sewing circle. So wherever you're kind of at and whatever skills you have, they can be used to be helped in time of a disaster.
That is so awesome. It represents, too, that the material resources that you give are not just things, but they come with emotion and spirituality that, you know, that Katrina quilt brings back memories of other people helping you. And that is so cool. That's so cool. In terms of responses in churches, so you do all the preparation and planning. What do churches or congregations have to think about when it comes to responding, not only in the short term, right, the day after the disaster, but also the medium and long term? What role do churches play there?
I think it's important for churches to realize that disasters can take months, sometimes years, sometimes even longer for a community to fully recover, depending on the size and scope of the disaster. That overall, I think people tend to think about a disaster response, kind of like what you were saying, that maybe just within the days, but the reality is it can take, you know, years for communities sometimes to respond. So in addition to thinking about planning their efforts to move along quickly, such as maybe providing immediate relief and supplies to people, to also start planning for how are we going to help people when everybody else leaves. So churches tend to be the first group on the ground to respond and the last because it's in their own communities. But if you look at a lot of organizations, many that respond to disasters will actually have a cutoff that we can only be in a community X amount of months or maybe even up to a year. But after that, we leave. That's part of our mandate from our organization. So when everybody else leaves, how is your church still going to respond? And some examples of that is to, like, for instance, after a superstorm, Sandy, many churches came together to help form a long-term recovery committee that tries to identify unmet needs in their communities and chip in resources that they may have to meet those needs or to reach out to other groups and organizations to meet those needs. So your federal groups and state groups may not realize or have relationships with the most vulnerable in the communities, whereas our churches often do.
Yeah, and churches are always there. They're great for long-term recovery responses, which is absolutely cool. So I want to,
and then you know, part of that too is thinking about even anniversaries. That again, a lot of other groups are going to be gone, but there's going to be these moments around anniversaries, holidays, maybe community happenings that are going to pull and be a trigger for a lot of people to bring back a lot of these painful memories and experiences. And churches are positioned to get out ahead of that, have prayer services, have anniversary services. You know, if you know somebody's particularly suffered, you know, go spend time with those people.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that, but that's brilliant. It helps the long-term recovery process. And again, churches are very well positioned to fill that role. Let me finish off with a few questions here. One of them is, does Wheaton College now have a plan that you're now in the office there?
They've actually had a disaster plan for quite some time before I ever got there.
Okay.
So we have a risk manager on campus and public security, and they've done an excellent job of making plans and getting preparations in place.
I can only imagine it's better now that you and David Bone are there, so. you got the worksheets and stuff, so I would assume that everybody at Wheaton has a copy of your book, or they should have a copy of your book.
Well, I don't know that everybody has one, we'll have to get on that.
We'll have to get on that, right? The last question, and this is one of my favorite questions I always ask of scholars, because scholarship is not just something that you put on paper, but it's actually a journey getting to those words on paper. Along the way of learning this over the past 15 years or so that you've, I should say 10 or 11 years ago since Katrina, is there anything that you learned that really surprised you or changed your mind about how you view the world?
You know, I think there's two events that really have changed the way I see the world. One is the mass disaster experience I had of Hurricane Katrina. And then 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and went through a personal disaster. And when I went through this, and I'm very grateful to say that I'm in remission now for 2 years. But when I was going through cancer, I had many moments where I realized the things that I've been studying and others around the globe going through disasters were playing out in my own personal life. And just really seeing the important role that faith plays in helping promote resilience. And I think the biggest shift for me has been not just thinking about resilience, but one of the areas where my scholarship is going to now that comes directly out of my cancer experience is starting to study the virtue of fortitude. That I had a sabbatical last fall, and I spent that semester reading my journal. I actually kept a journal when I was going through cancer. And going through that journal, I realized that the definitions that we use for resilience didn't fully capture some of the spiritual experiences or even physical experiences that I underwent during that year, and surely didn't capture some of the experiences of other people with cancer who shared their stories with me.
Wow. Wow. That is very powerful. I hope you're going to write a book on that.
well, I'm actually working on a proposal, so we'll see how that goes.
Well,
so,
that's something that...
And actually... I just gave a talk, and you can go to my website, jamieayton.com, and to the speaking page and watch a plenary talk I just gave on being a walking disaster, cultivating faith and resilience in times of personal crisis.
Well, we will definitely link up to that on our website so people can go and visit it, because it does bring your broad-based research back home to something very personal, and I think that's some of the best scholarship, is that when we can reflect upon the world around us through our own eyes and lives and be very honest about the experiences that we're going through. Very powerful scholarship, and I want to commend you for doing that, and we look forward to a lot more writing on this topic in the future. My guest today has been Jamie Ayton. Jamie, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.